The Leadership Platform is brought to you by Sibanye Gold, a proudly South African mining company.
I am the future of South Africa. On my shoulders, I carry the hopes and dreams of generations to come. I'm eager to learn, but even more eager to use my knowledge for good. I know that it's not where I come from, but where I'm going to that really matters.
At Sibanye Gold, we believe our youth is worth its weight in gold, which is why we are so committed to developing, nurturing, and grooming our young people into future leaders. Sibanye Gold, we are one.
This is your weekly leadership master class. First half hour is like a master lesson with a lot of practical conversation as well. In the second half hour, we zoom in on our special guest. So that's how we run the show. And of course, you can go to leadershipplatform.com, two P's in the middle, for all things leadership articles and often summaries of these conversations we have. In the studio, our usual panel, Louis Groenewald and Rich Simmons. Good to have you with us. As always,
good to be here. Thank you.
And today is a fascinating conversation. In fact, we probably won't do it justice in this short time that we have, because we're talking all about culture. Culture eats strategy for breakfast and all that stuff. And what an important element in business. On the line also, Professor Theo Veldsmann from UJ. Prof, welcome.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the opportunity to join you. Also, afternoon to the listeners.
Yeah, it's so good to have you with us. It's a big conversation. Very important one, and in the studio also, forming part of the panel, and then the second half of the show, we'll zoom in on him, particularly as a leader, and maybe even closer to his business, is Carl Kumbia, CEO of Mercantile Bank. Welcome, Carl.
Yeah, thanks for having the show, Adrian.
All right, so, I mean, Mercantile Bank, definitely not the biggest bank, but man, I'm impressed with what I see so far, your essence, your focus, what you've done over the last few years. We've had your HR executive on the show.
Okay.
Dalien Sechele, yeah, so he's been more than once on our panel, and it's been wonderful. We felt her energy, and there's energy in that business. So we'll expand on that in the second half, but in this first half, we're going to focus on culture. A reminder, last week we spoke about impossibility thinking and doing. How do you achieve the impossible, the kind of mindset you need? In our world today, we really need that. The world seems like an impossible place. Very challenging, very, very difficult, but exciting. And lots of opportunities, but you need to see the impossibility and then make it possible. So download that podcast if you want to learn more. Culture, 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 culture. I mean, it is said a strong, distinct organizational culture can improve organizational performance by 20 to 30% compared to an unremarkable weak culture. I mean, in today's world, any business would be happy if they can improve by 20 to 30%. So is that true? That's amazing. Culture eats strategy for breakfast, they say. These days, anyone can copy a competitor's strategy. I mean, we're so connected and linked. It's very easy, I guess, to see what your competitor is doing. But they cannot replicate your culture. They can't easily create the same sort of culture that it may need in order to achieve that strategy. So, Prof. Theo Veldsmann, maybe give us a quick insight into what is a culture as you see it, sort of from the theoretical perspective.
Adrian, you know, the typical description of culture out there is the way we do things, which is true. But I think we have to look at culture wider than that, because culture also influences, and it's always shared. Hey, if it's not shared amongst the organizational members, it can't be culture. So that's a very important characteristic feature of culture. But it's more than only doing things together in a shared way. It's also how an organization sees the world. In other words, do we see the world as a threat or an opportunity? How do we interpret that world? I mean, if you can see the world full of opportunities, do you then act upon it in terms of, here is really stuff that we can do in an organization? So my way of looking at culture is a somewhat expanded way to say it's the shared ways of seeing, interpreting, and acting upon the world as a group of people in an organization. It's the glue holding the organization together.
All right, and there's a little bit more, but let's, Carl, from your perspective, out there doing it. I mean, you last few years with your team, you have been consciously working on a culture shift. But we're not going to go into that detail for now. How do you see culture?
I think it's exactly right. Strategy is very important, obviously. But strategy is actually the easier part of, I suppose, of trying to take a business to the next level. It's how do you get everyone in your, I suppose, team to buy into the strategy? How do you get the team motivated? How do you get everyone to channel all the energy and passion into the same direction so that you can actually go and execute on your strategy? So I think culture is probably the most important part of any organization. And I think it's also very important that once you've worked out what your strategy is to ensure that you have, or you build the right culture to be able to achieve that strategy. Mm. Because every organization is different, yeah. Mm. And even like in banking, you've got so many different banks in this country, an investing culture is very different to, say, a Standard Bank culture. And even within, say, a Standard Bank, you've got a retail banking culture and an investment bank culture. So you've got to work out what is the right culture for your business unit in order to take that to the next level. Huh?
It's a fascinating topic. Rich, your views, thoughts on culture, and then Louis?
Yeah, definitely, as Carl says, it needs to be built. And you can only build it with the people. So it's, and then your strategy can come together. But if you forget the people, then you'll never get your strategy properly right.
Yeah, it's all around the people, I would guess. Louis, your comments?
The prof used the expression before, which we often use, this about body language. In other words, not what you say, but what you magnify out there. And culture, you can sense and feel. What we love, Prof, about this culture business is how vital it is at all levels. We've got a show for leadership in school principals, for instance, and we have some top performers here, and all they seem to passionately focus on is building that culture of it can be done in spite of poverty, etc. And we see some tremendous results by people have that attitude.
But I mean, whether you consciously work on a culture or not, you have one, don't you?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you have one.
It's about defining it, knowing what it currently is, and is that actually what we want? I guess if you're not achieving your results, then you probably don't have the culture you want or need. Would that be fair?
Well, I can give you one example, and I want to start firstly by, a practical case. The Shona of South Africa has got a beautiful saying, which I really think is powerful. They say, the saying says, the power of the fish is in the water. Mm. And the water equates here to the culture. This particular, one of the major banks decided, I don't know which part of the bank, to become more innovative. You know, innovation was going to drive this strategy. They got consultants in to define what an innovative employee would look like. They recruited them from, and about 3 months later, they said, please come and fetch these people. They're not paying any attention. They're wrecking everything. They don't obey rules. So the people did not fit the culture, although that was the strategy. So very much this point of culture creates the conditions under which people can perform the enablement, the empowerment. The enablement for me is I've got the stuff to do the job with. The empowerment is I've got the freedom to act in terms of the strategy. You can't divorce the two.
All right. If we had to say culture is solely determined by the people, that probably wouldn't be accurate. You've got hardware and software, don't you?
Mm. You have to, culture gets externalized. Hey, it gets internalized in the people, their behavior seen, but then you set it up. I mean, if you believe you're an innovative company, you're bringing in innovative employees, then the conditions in the company, the physical stuff, should also then engender innovation. You can't have people just locked up in offices. They're walking at the beginning of the day, 5 o'clock, they leave again. They never have interacted to. Interesting what some companies have done in terms of just how they do the physical layout such that people, innovation, can interact and they can act across functions.
Mm.
So there's a hardware side and a software side.
All right. So
culture.
On the hardware side, you've got two triangles that you shared with me on a previous occasion, rewards and recognition, performance, work practices and standards, structures and roles, leadership, philosophy, vision and mission. On the soft triangle, and I don't know if one agrees with it all, but this gives some guidelines. On the soft side, it's a need satisfaction, behavior, attitudes, perceptions, feelings, and thoughts. values, assumptions, and beliefs. I would guess that the soft side is the harder one. That's very strongly linked to people in many ways.
Well, what we've learned, it takes about 3 to 5 years. If you always got a culture, can only but support what you said there. But it can take anything between 3 to 5 years to establish, entrench, institutionalize a new culture. It is not Friday we end with one culture, Monday, on Friday late we've got an email going out instructing everybody as from Monday we'll have a caring culture, and right, 8 o'clock Monday morning we've got a caring culture.
Okay. So it's not an easy thing. Carl, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's right. You definitely have the software side and the hardware. Now, on the software side, I'm a big believer in empowerment. So you empower your staff to be able to perform to their best. But often you need to give the staff the tools to be able to do the job properly.
Mm.
And if I look at the whole, say, the HR, I suppose, line end to end, you want to obviously employ the right people to fit your culture, to what the prof said earlier. And then once you've employed the right people, you want to make sure we've got lots of great people in the organization already. You want to make sure you hold on to those people, that you're keeping them satisfied from a job point of view. And then you've got to make sure that you provide the necessary training to get them to the right level. And then very important is give them the tools to be able to do the job effectively. And once that's all done and they've performed really well, then you've got to have a transparent appraisal process to make sure that if you have done your job well, that you're going to be rewarded and looked after. Yeah, and that's, I suppose, more from the hardware side, is that you'll be looked after from that point of view. So no, I agree 100% with that theory.
Theo, comment back?
Yes, maybe for the moment, because it's become such an important theme in organizations, if they want to remain at the front of the game, this innovation. Let's say your strategy is innovation. Innovation implies that people will have to be allowed, empowered, and able to experiment, try out new things. It means also then that the kind of in your performance appraisal, you then now don't punish people if they make mistakes. And it's so interesting for me very often when I engage with organizations and I see that one of their core values, I ask them, please list me a couple of the major mistakes you've made in recent times and how you dealt with them. The moment say, we can't really come up with any examples here, so you haven't got an innovative culture. Because it means, innovation means pushing boundaries, asking questions, thinking out of the box. You're bound to make mistakes because the answers are not clear. And in particular, if you then just reward people that have been successful, you should also reward people, because there's kind of that money that goes in a training investment. If people made tried these things, they didn't work, see that as moving up the learning curve.
Rich?
Yeah, there's an interesting thing. I was reading a report the other day. If you want to kill innovation in your company, just reward it. So only reward the failure. Don't reward the success. And then your innovation will continue to grow. But if you reward it, you'll definitely kill it.
But, I mean, F&B would disagree, though. They turn their innovators with great ideas into I don't know if they turn them into euros.
How are they rewarding it? That's the thing.
Well, the question is whether they rewarded the idea, a great idea, or the actual idea implemented into achievement. But they give $1 million. Huge reward, and they make them euros. So innovation is hugely rewarded, and they became the most innovative bank in the world. So it's fascinating, I'm sure. But now, hold on, you could have a culture where it doesn't work. That's what I'm trying to say here. It's culture as an... Here's a question: is that does culture drive strategy, or does strategy drive culture? It might be a silly question, but give me your views on that.
Culture first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah. Once again, I think you first have to have a strategy for organization as to where you want to go, and then make sure you mold your culture accordingly to deliver. But I think I read quite a we Citadel came and did a presentation to us a few months ago. And they had a look at the economy and the growth in the economy over, say, the last 10 to 15 years. And there's a direct correlation between growth in the economy and companies listed on the stock exchange, their results, right, from a net profit point of view. Now, about a 70% correlation. So what they're saying is if the economy does well, then most companies at JSE will do well. If it does badly, then most companies' profits drop. But there were six companies that bucked the trend. And the entire JSE, only six, they grew at more than 10% a year for 10 years in a row. Didn't matter what the economy did. And they then went and analyzed all the attributes of these companies. And the one was innovation, But what stands out is that it says they innovate at every level in the organization. So it's not just the senior team. It's every single person in the organization. It doesn't matter what level you are. If you can do things quicker, if you can make the customer experience but better, then, yeah, then you need to get that idea somewhere on the table. Then someone that can make a decision and say, yes, it's going to implement the idea.
So clearly a culture, if it's on all levels, then it's a culture. Yeah, if it's just at the top, it's not.
Yeah.
But I want to bounce back now, and Prof, come in here. So in my mind, I have this picture. Okay, that you do have a strategy and you've got a culture, and maybe there's elements in your culture that must follow your strategy. Okay, I understand that, but if we also say that culture cannot be copied, but strategy can, then there's a missing link for me. Because for me, almost the enduring thing, the differentiator in your business, no matter how your strategy adapts or shifts or changes, is your culture.
Yeah.
So there must be some generic solid element. So if you have a culture of we achieve the impossible, we can do anything as a team, we put our mind to it, and we just have this can-do attitude across the business, that call is not linked to the strategy. Mm. So there's two elements to your culture. Tell me if you agree. One is hopefully you can ingrain a certain sort of culture that maybe of resilience or whatever, that will always be there no matter how the strategy changes. But then there's other elements of your culture that follows the strategy directly. Prof, your view?
You know, I tend to look somewhat differently at the world. I think these two things interact, and sometimes it's very difficult. That's why at the injection of what comes first, the chicken or the egg, is I think there's a interaction between the two. Hmm. In the sense that you have innovation, that allows you to think completely differently about your strategy. Or you have a strategy, and that has to be matched to the culture. Can I use the analogy here of a body? You know, you've got the brain and you've got the body. You're preparing to run the comrades. Yes, you are fit to run the comrades, but in the end, it's your mind that pushes you through to actually help you to complete the race. So these things interact. Of course, you have to start somewhere, but it's kind of you're juggling two balls. And can I introduce a third one? Because there's a very, very important other relationship here, which we have not directly touched on. And that is what has been found. There's a 70% relationship between the leadership and the culture of the organization. Mm. So it's kind of you juggling the balls here. And the one, in moving in the one, it allows you to do more with the other one. And so you move on. And so it's an upward virtual type of pattern that you establish.
All right. And I'm going there next. Louis, any comments before we...
No, Adrian, my feeling is pretty strong that in terms of the interaction that Prof is mentioning, quite frankly, if you want to be authentic, then these two should be the same in a real sense of the word. Because once you start differentiating functionally too much, you lose the authenticity. So therefore, there's simplicity to it if you can master it. It's a constant interaction, mm-hmm. which, of course, should allow you to change along the way. But I can't see it, Prof. I agree with you. I can't see it being really two separate items. Not really.
No, but maybe I'm on a different level here. But I'm preparing for the comrades, okay? I have to have a different program for the comrades, a different strategy, than I would for, what's this crazy one where they run like 31 days and... Or was that a cycling thing? Anyway, something that. But now I'm going for a 100-kilometer race, or something further, or something in New York, the New York race. So I have to now have a different strategy for that race. But the one thing that I might have above the other athlete is an amazing resilience, or a deep passion to succeed, deeper than the next guy. So my strategy on how to prepare for a different race changes, but because I have that inherent culture in me of succeeding, or it's more an inherent thing that I've built inside of me, I can actually go and do any race and probably do well.
But Adrian, if I may come in here, what made you in the first place decide in your mind that I can do this race before you started preparing? You first had that view, I can do it, now I prepare. And then it feeds back, I'm prepared, so I can do the race.
Feeding back to each other. Cole?
It reminds me of a story. Remember Mike Tyson? I suppose he's still around now, but when he was about 19, I think he won the world title. And then they had a documentary on him, and he was running at 3 o'clock in the morning. He was running cold wherever he lived in the States. And they asked him, why are you running at 3 o'clock in the morning? He says, no, because I know my competitor's not doing it, right? So he was there.
Yeah.
So, but I think, you know, if we go back to the strategy versus the culture, and I was going to chat about it just now, but I think it's quite a good timing to bring it in. Now, at Mercantile, you know, when we looked at it a couple of years ago, we said, that we wanted to take the bank to, you know, to another level, basically double the size of the bank. So we're never going to be a big bank, but we wanted to be the number one bank in the SME space. And we actually got an outside organization to come have a look at our culture. And they came in, and then what ended up being is we had three different cultures, subcultures, because the bank was a merger of two banks in the past, so you got the two different cultures there. Then we had the old Bank of Lisbon culture, which is very relationship-driven, but not very performance-driven, if you look at it that way, you know. And then we had what we call the Dirty Dozen, which the guys came in about 14 years ago when the bank had one or two issues. They came in as very autocratic leadership style, but very results-driven. And then the new culture is like the younger, I suppose the younger generation being the what we call the high street. And then what we said was there's no right or wrong culture, but there's a particular culture we needed to take this bank to the next level. So we actually looked at the three cultures and we pulled out the best out of each. And funny enough, we took the Bank of Lisbon, their relationship, it was a core to our strategy to say, right, how do we make this relationship the core to our culture? And we built everything around that. And I'd say within the space of 2 years, we've now molded this thing into one culture, which is, you know, which has done fantastically well for our business.
It's a great, perfect case study. Now, coming back to the 70% correlation between the leadership at the top, that's a concern, Prof. Rich, all of you in the studio here. CEOs stay on average 3 to 5 years. I think that model is being challenged by several leaders out there. But still, if it takes that long to stabilize or to create, embed a culture, and so much comes from the top, and I almost want to say the very top, the CEO and his team, yes, but particularly the CEO. How does that bode? I mean, in today's world, we have to move very fast. What happens to the culture when a new leader comes in? You came in, Carl, there was a certain culture or three subcultures, let's say. But then now you've created your own culture, but you might leave in a year or two, who knows? What happens to that culture? And does cultures just change every time when the new leader comes on board? Certainly not.
No, but I think it's you. Remember that it's an organizational culture. It's not a leadership. You know, it's not the leader or the CEO's culture. So, I mean, when you want to drive your culture, it starts from the top. You know, so you have to drive it hard from the CEO downwards. Because if the CEO doesn't buy into the culture, you know, how can the rest of the organization buy into the strategy or to the culture? And if you don't live the values of that organization, yeah, and you show it on a day-to-day basis, yeah, why would the rest of the staff do it? So. Like what we did was we made sure that every one of our when we came up with our strategy and the culture we wanted, all our business unit heads, remember, and there's probably like 19, 20 business unit heads in our business, so each person's running a business. We made sure that they, ate, slept, and drank the culture on a daily basis, and then that they went back to their business units and their managers reporting to them would go and live the culture and it carried on like that. So it cascades right throughout the organization. So to me, you're building a culture in the organization where if the CEO left tomorrow, it wouldn't impact on the actual business. As long as the new CEO that comes in leads by example again.
Carl, I can only support what you say there. I mean, there's the key operative term for me, shared. The moment the culture is just inside the CEO, Adrian, it is not the culture of the organization. It is to make the converts, the disciples, the apostles that actually, regardless, so to speak, who the CEO is, that they can carry on. But also here, I think the CEO, but also then if you only refer to the CEO, the board, of the company plays a critical role. If they have to now look at a new CEO, do they understand the culture, the strategy and the leadership, that critical triangle, how those three things go together, and do they then select the right CEO? Or is it just a kind of, they look at the technical stuff and what this person has achieved, and they don't ask the soft questions, so to speak, with respect to this.
That's a very good point. But so as we speak here, we know that the next CEO can bring it all down. The next CEO can change the whole culture with his or her personality and changing the strategy. I mean, that's the power of a leader. A leader can literally, but if it is shared across the business, that is the new CEO who wants to change. That's his biggest enemy in a way. I mean, now he's got to break it all down again and build a new culture. We see too much of that. And maybe it happens at the board level. You see boards, they're not connected enough with the business. You've got a supportive board, as I understand, Cole.
Yes, no, definitely. I mean, a lot of our board has been to the bank for probably 10 years, 10 to 12 years, and then there's a few new board members. But I think it once again starts at the top. So if the board hasn't bought into your strategy and the board doesn't live by the culture and the rest of the organization, then it's not going to happen because then your CEO starts operating in a different way and then your senior team has a look at this and then it'll cascade downwards again. So So to me, it's from the top down. You have to live be part of that same culture.
But gentlemen, do you think that executive teams actually sell the strategy to the board more than they do the culture? Doesn't it go wrong there sometimes? They really say, this is the strategy and the board buys into it. Maybe you must do an equally hard selling job or effective selling job on, therefore, the culture that we now need in this business is X, Y, and Z, clearly. The board must understand that too. Prof?
Very much. And can I add to that? I mean, I would like to hear from the panelists. Do you know of any company where the CEO or the senior leadership, well, at their respective levels, or you can actually include the whole leadership group, as part of the KPI, in their performance contract is culture? We're just not building that in. So what are people focusing on? They're focusing on other types of results, called it the hard results, and not the soft results. Sometimes we assume if you get this hard stuff right, then you did okay on the soft side. But okay. I think we must include culture and leadership as KPIs and KPAs in our performance contract.
So I think there are a lot of businesses who would push back and say, but we do measure the behavior and the living of the values in our performance management system. So would that then, Cole, Louis, Rich, does that count as, if your values capture your culture, and you then measure the living of the values, then I guess you're on a good wicket, but I'm not sure that always matches fully.
No, but I think the prof is spot on, because we call it a balanced scorecard. So numbers is one part of your scorecard, but myself, as example, probably about half of my KPIs are numbers-based. The rest is implementing a strategy, the people, the softer stuff in the business. And there are measurables in place. We have a staff, a dipstick survey once a year to see what the staff motivation level is like, et cetera. So you can pull all of these type of things. You can look at your staff turnover rates as well. Yeah, those type of things. So there's definitely measurables in place where you can measure the softer side of the business.
Rich?
Yeah, it's so important what the prof said there, because, are you working, if what Peter Drucker says, and it's culture eats strategy for breakfast, then you've got to look at your culture first. And I'm reminded about a story with Southwest Airlines, where they're looking for a new pilot. And, they friendly and it's a happy experience to fly with. So this pilot arrives, and even from the time he gets onto the plane to go to the head office, he's rude to the staff.
Mm.
When he gets to the reception, he's rude. Mm. And they sort of tell the story upwards, and he never gets to get to the interview. Because the culture of the company is, we don't need rude people here. We need people that are friendly with our customers. So you can't fly one of our jets if you're a rude person. And, that's just the perfect example of what the professor was asking there about, is our KPI culture? Or was it just the skills? Because clearly, if this guy was invited for the interview, he's probably one of the best pilots.
Yeah, his skills are good.
Yeah, but the culture is wrong for the organization.
All right, we can talk a lot about this. Louis, last view on culture, and then Cole, and we have the prof say something briefly, and then we'll go.
Thank you, prof. We appreciate your participation. A positive culture and organization, organizational trust and authenticity and emotional intelligence are so interacted or interrelated that you can't separate them. So, if we want to be honest about that, we are the culture of the organization as leaders.
Cole?
Yeah, I think culture is the most important part of any organization. And if your staff are motivated, fired up, passionate, that'll result in better service to your customers. You'll have more customers, and at the end of the day, the bottom line will look after itself. So I think it is the most important part of any organization.
A really strong culture lasts beyond the current leader into the next leader and the next leader.
Exactly.
And that's why I think there's some element in culture that's deeper than being linked to the strategy direct. Become so generically who you are, that the next leader shouldn't be able to change that. And that's things like can-do attitude. That's not necessarily linked to a strategy, but they do interplay. I agree. Prof, last word?
Yes, I think culture, very important. Everybody stressed that. I think in a ever-changing world, fundamental change, virtuality, hyper-turbulence, culture keeps you together. Because in the end, culture also projects the brand out there. The brand of the organization attracts people. It keeps talent. So, yes, culture is major organizational business.
Professor Theo Felsman from UJ, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, before we take a quick break, I want to stretch it a little bit further. We're going to take a quick break and then come back and focus on Carl Kumbia, the CEO of Mercantile Bank, a little bit about him, about his background and the bank itself, the good things that they're doing there, and there will be a strong link between our master lesson that we've just gone through and, of course, this conversation. Two or three tweets. I'm concerned about the negativity in the country. Next week, we'll talk about miracle leadership. The prof actually wrote an article which we started reading. There's a huge negativity in the country. I don't know. We can unpack it next week in more detail. But I've been sort of leaning towards very positive sort of tweets to try and play a small role. The one that I sent now very recently, I think last night, that's gone quite far, is to turn a tide of negativity, one must go the extra mile. May all of us in South Africa do a little more this week. You know, we won't turn a negative tide by just doing what you're supposed to do every day. That's the given. We've got to do a little bit more to turn it around. Lead beyond where you currently find yourself. There's a quote that says, positive thoughts generate positive feelings and attract positive life experiences, from quote diary. And I added, while this should be your attitude, always identify and confront negatives around you head on in a positive way. And then there's another one. Think positive, be positive, and positive things will happen. We can debate that, but we don't have time. Many who once felt optimistic about South Africa, I believe, are turning negative. And I'm saying, please don't. Fight hard and think and be positive today, this week. And the last one, the world is a dangerous place, not because of those who do evil, but because of those who look on and do nothing, said Albert Einstein. We've got to do more. We can't just look on and criticize government or whoever we feel like criticizing. We've got to do more. Stay with us. Next up, Carl Kumbia, CEO, Mercantile Bank, and a little bit more about him, his business, and culture. Herman Mashaba, top entrepreneur and founder of Black Like Me, says, this book captures our South African leadership heritage well. Gareth Cliff says, better, more effective leadership is the one thing every South African agrees we need. What makes a great leader? Read this book. Neil Froneman, CEO Sibanye Gold, says seamless leadership is a vital contribution to grooming a future generation of leaders that will guide our nation through turbulent passages that inevitably lie ahead. Ian Donald, Nestle South Africa CEO, says, as one of South Africa's foremost leadership experts, Adrian Groenewald clearly outlines the approach leaders across the globe should adopt. Whether you are a CEO, a manager, a teacher, politician, or parent, get yourself and your team a copy of Seamless Leadership, Universal Lessons from South Africa. This book and the principles it teaches is exactly what you and the world need now. Visit your nearest exclusive books or CNA store, or, of course, order from Amazon.
At Sibanye Gold, we believe leaders are made, not born. We also believe we can create a sustainable legacy by helping to develop tomorrow's leaders today. Which is why we have partnered with the Leadership Platform to nurture leaders who are committed to growing our country's economy.
We are proud to say it's an initiative that's already showing glittering results. Sibanye Gold, we are one.